damn late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Eric Margolese. He is the author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj. And he writes, of course, at ericmargolese.com. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Eric?
Thank you, Scott. As always, glad to be back with you.
Very happy to have you here. And, you know, I was really happy to see that you wrote this obit for Yuri Avnery, or Avnery, I don't know. We used to run him all the time at antiwar.com. Not every single column, but pretty much. At antiwar.com, and he was such an interesting character who, of course, died last week. And so I thought, what a great opportunity to have you on to talk all about him. Apparently, of course, you knew the guy. So do tell.
Well, Scott, I didn't know him personally, to my sorrow, but I certainly read his column every week, which I got, and had enormous respect for him. He really, I felt an affection for him too. He was this overused maverick. He was stuck by his principles. He was like a biblical prophet in telling the Israelis what they were doing wrong with the Palestinians. He was hated and reviled as a result, and nevertheless, he was a great man who wrote with enormous moral force and great intellectual clarity.
Mm-hmm. And now, so you write all about his background there, too. And I guess, you know, we'll talk about the clarity on the independence for the Palestinians and all that. But can you just tell us a little bit about his background and why he was such an important writer?
Sure. He was born in Germany. In the 1920s, and his family, who were Jewish, emigrated to then British-ruled Palestine in the 1930s to escape the Nazi movement. He was a firebrand when he was young. He joined the Irgun, which was really what in today's terminology would be called a terrorist group, a Jewish terrorist group, that attacked Arabs, attacked Arab villages, attacked British targets, and committed very serious crimes, but to try and shock the British out of Palestine. But he tired, grew sickened by these excesses, the murderous nature of the Irgun, and eventually he went on to form a position with young Jewish moderates. Meanwhile, he served in the Israeli military in his irregular units. He fought. He was seriously wounded up in Galilee. He saw a great deal of fighting and eventually had his share of war and vitriol and anger and things. And he moved over to a centrist position and began calling, after the 1967 war, where Israel gained a huge amount of territory, he began calling for humane and enlightened policy towards the Palestinians and for creation of a Palestinian state.
Right. Well, so, and now, was it not until after 67 that he started pushing for independence? I thought it was really right after the 48 war, no?
I think it was after the 48 war. You're right. But he didn't. That was a sort of a personal position. He became politically active and formed the peace movement and finally won a seat in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, after the 67 war. My dates could be off.
Yeah. No, I guess that sounds right. And believe me, I'm not an expert on it. But anyway, you know, so it always seemed, well, first of all, one of the things remarkable about reading his articles is that, of course, he's there all along. As you said, moved to Palestine in 1933, fought in the 48 war, and then, you know, at least mostly knew better all along, as the pro-war party in Israel has done exactly the opposite of follow his advice this whole time. But so, you know, he's on a first-name basis with all of the most famous Israeli leaders of this whole time and is constantly telling stories about why they all hated Shimon Peres or why, you know, that one time he met with Ariel Sharon right before the Sabra and Shatila massacre, or whatever it is. You know, he's got 1,000 anecdotes. I may have made up that last one, I forget. But 1,000 little anecdotes about all of these guys and what he told them to not do that they did anyway, basically, right?
That's correct. He was the insider in Israeli politics. And I must say, he as much as he was hated by the right wing, which called him a traitor, and right wing tried to kill him once, and he was... vitriol was poured on him. A certain amount of Israelis respected him, too, because he wouldn't yield in his views. And I think deep down at heart, many, even on Israel's far right, knew that what he was saying was true.
Yeah. Well, and this is kind of one of the strange things, right, is that I guess he would be characterized as some far leftist for having this view, I guess, because this is the only issue that really matters, right, is what to do with the Palestinians and their land. And yet, independence for the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, but that's the consensus. That's been the position of the U.S. government, at least officially, as well as the entire rest of the world, right? That's not a radical leftist position at all, to just say give up the West Bank and Gaza and let them have their measly 22% of what's left of Palestine. Isn't that's that correct. What everybody thinks, only except the Likud?
Well, it was until Trump came along. But now even that very de minimis position of the United States is being reduced and rescinded today. That awful creature, Nikki Haley at the UN, announced another diatribe against the Palestinians and how can't give them any more money, cutting off aid to the UN organization UNRWA. And which has been feeding the Palestinians all these years. So the Israelis kicked out the Palestinians. They took their land and they got the Americans to pay for them, to give them just enough food to stay alive. But now even this food supply is under threat.
The Americans is right. I don't know if you meant to say that or not, but it's hard to not make that mistake. Yeah, well, and so... But yeah, isn't that strange, though, that, you know, basically just, I mean, the American rule aside for the moment, that just even, you know, in terms of Israeli politics, that just basic fairness and good sportsmanship in victory is completely off the table. And even though America supposedly outlawed after World War II invading other countries and occupying their land and transferring civilian colonists onto conquered land, the Israelis do it all the time, get away with it anyway. They have this, I guess, slow motion, not too slow, but somewhat slow motion annexation of the West Bank going on in front of everyone's eyes. And and Yuri Avnery, for what a great example he set, really also just proved what a marginal position it is in Israeli politics that, hey, guys, this is kind of, you know, untenable. I mean, Ehud Barak, right, would say things like that sometimes, that this is apartheid and it's not going to work over the long term, that kind of thing. But certainly never really fought about it and was a bad prime minister on these issues when he was in charge of them. But so, I mean, I guess I don't really know, but am I right, though? It seems like Yuri Avner's position in Israeli politics really was considered to be a far marginal leftist position, that the Palestinians ought to have any form of real self-government at all.
That's right. It's for supporting terrorism. That's what the far right would say, as it was gobbling up Palestinian land. But Israel's left wing was generally in favor, to varying degrees, of making some kind of peace agreement with the Palestinians. And the trouble is that the left lost its potency in Israel, and the United States undermined Israel's pro-peace left movement. So in the net result, all the support went to the increasingly ever more right-wing Likud party, which Uri Avneri, by the way, refers to as semi-fascists.
Avneri, see, I could have probably learned how to pronounce that at some point. Yeah, well, and so I don't know. It seems like there must be more to say, because I think about how valuable his articles have been week in and week out for years now to me. But I hate to give him short shrift. He ought to be remembered, you know, even better than we're doing so far. Eric, say some more things.
Well, I always regard him as the conscience of Israel. He spoke the words that no one wanted to hear. I try and do that when I write my own columns. I very often write about unpalatable, unpleasant, unwelcome truths. And people usually don't want the truth. They want to be told how great they are. But unfortunately, he wouldn't tolerate that for a minute. And I thought he was very important, because we do not have a comparable figure in the Arab world. Avneri was really a one of a kind, and he showed that in Israel, no matter how much it's criticized, that there are men of goodwill who want to reach a reasonable peace agreement with their neighbors. But the problem is that the neighbors really are not in favor of peace, because they're saying, well, wait a minute, we're the aggrieved party. They took all our land away, now they want peace. Well, we want our land back first.
Right. Yeah, it's such a dishonest framing, as though peace is the issue. Like, there's a war on and there's going to be a peace treaty, instead of the war was over almost as soon as it started back in 67. The Palestinians lost, and now they're being occupied and stolen from writ large, you know. Just, oh yeah, when are the Palestinians ever going to come to the table? Like, they're not already locked up in an internment camp. Just the whole framing. You got to hand it to them, though, the brilliance of, you know, twisting the truth of just the most basic terms that these issues are discussed in, you know.
Well, it has. The pro-Israeli groups in the United States have a great influence with the U.S. media. They own Congress, and they own Mr. Trump, too, or he owns them. I don't know who owns who, but their influence is paramount, and there's nobody on the other side to say anything. Like, I know when I write a column where I call for a Palestinian state and some kind of justice for these terribly downtrodden people, I get all kinds of hate mail and angry letters, and my newspaper publishers are threatened, and there's a storm. And there's nothing from the other side. Occasional letters saying, "Dear Mr. Eric, thank you very much." But by and large, there's no countervailing pressure group to help get the story out. So we get one side. Thus it has been since the 1940s in the U.S. You know, my mother was one of the first American journalists to really crisscross the Middle East, and a woman on her own. And this was in the early 50s. And she was finally silenced. The newspapers for whom she wrote were threatened with advertiser boycotts. People came banging on our door at night, threatening to kill me, throw acid in my face. Well, this is after the war, too, you know, and passions were running high. But the point was that my mother and other people who tried to show that there were millions of Palestinians living in tents were silenced.
Well, and, you know, here's the thing, too, is people understand now, I mean, if they're interested in this stuff at all, the story of the Nakba and the 750,000 people who were rousted out of their homes. But there was a giant lie that stood for years, right? That this was a land without people. So when your mother was reporting that, that was a big deal. She was undermining the major premise of the Zionist project that, hey, no harm, no foul. There was no one here to steal from. It was fine.
That's right, Scott. It was the big primary lie. Land without people for a people without land. It was a great slogan. It just was a lie.
Yeah, really amazing. All right, now listen here, folks, because it's not going to keep coming up because the man's dead. He had a stroke and then heart failure, and that was it. He was, what, 93 or 92, 94 years old, something. But we have his archive at antiwar.com, and, of course, it's at gushshalom.com. I think there's a hyphen in there, gushshalom.com. And, you know, it's one of those things where if you were to just go back and read quite a few dozen of those articles, you would learn so much of the context of the state of Israel from the get-go through the eyes of a guy who was there all along. And it's really important stuff. So I do hope that everyone, well, at least some of you guys will really dive in and read a lot of that. But so speaking of which, then, you know, in terms of about Israel and their hold on the current administration, as you were talking about there, Eric, what about Iran? They pulled out of the deal. They've got, you know, they're going to extraordinary lengths, I guess, to force these new sanctions and to force European companies to stop dealing with the Iranians. And, you know, they're convinced, and there's a great article in Loblog, I'm going to try to get the guy on, a great article about how the Iranian regime is not about to fall, but at the same time, how many of the administration officials have convinced themselves that it is. It's the foundation for defense of democracies, along with John Bolton, the, you know, neocon ally. Anyway, he's not really a neocon, but he's very close with them, of course, the whole AEI set. And, you know, they seem to have as a major premise of their, you know, Iranian policy here, of the brittleness of the regime, I guess, and how they'll be able to topple it pretty soon. It'll be like the fall of the Soviet Union or some kind of thing. So you think that's right? And do you think that's right? Or do you think that's crazy?
It's wrong. It's wishful thinking on steroids. You know, we heard the exact same theory in dealing with Iraq. The idea was to make life such hell for ordinary Iraqis through sanctions, boycotts, that they would eventually rise up and overthrow Saddam, who had become disobedient to Washington's tutelage. And it didn't happen. And in fact, you remember when President Bush called for Iraqis to rise up and revolt, they were squashed. The Great Rebellion didn't happen. I'm talking Bush won. So, but this is a cherished dream in Washington, promoted by all these arms of the Israel lobby, like the Heritage Foundation, Defense of Democracies, et cetera, et cetera. And the news media keeps playing up and saying, oh, Iranians are unhappy at the government spending money in Iraq to help defend the Iraqis. I have never seen anything like this in the local media. It is a wishful thought. And while there are obviously certain Iranians who are suffering and fed up with the economic warfare being waged against Iran by the United States, I don't think this is going to result in the overthrow of the government.
The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by books. particularly Kesslin Runs, a new dystopian novel about the very near future by the great Charles Featherstone. Kesslin Runs. Also, No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani, and The War State by Mike Swanson, about the rise of the military-industrial complex in America after World War II. He also gives great investment advice at WallStreetWindow.com. And when you follow his advice, you'll want to get some precious metals, gold and silver and et cetera, from Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. That's at rrbi.co, rrbi.co. Also, check out Zencash at zencash.com or zensystem.io. It's a great digital currency, but it's also a messaging app and a document transfer app and all kinds of great stuff, too. Learn all about it at zencash.com. And then there's Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. If you sign up from the link on my page at scotthorton.org, I'll get a little bit of a kickback there. And check this out. Speaking of scotthorton.org, if you'd like expanddesigns.com to build you a new 2018 model website, go to expanddesigns.com/Scott and you'll save $500. Also, don't forget the bumpersticker.com. Stickers for your band or your business at very reasonable prices. High quality stuff there. It used to be my company back when. Thebumpersticker.com. Yeah. Well, and it's just like you were saying, though, about, you know, the issues of Palestine on the ground there. When it comes to Iran, there's no counterforce. There's no other side of the argument. It's not like there's an Iran lobby. You know, you have people like Trita Parsi, who's like, hey, 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 I'm an American. I'm just for peace with Iran. But you don't have anyone who says, you know, who's outright on the payroll of the Iranians pushing their view. Instead, you have these things that are, you know, like you're talking about, obviously cooked up in some Washington, D.C. PR firm that, I mean, even the way they said it was, you know, completely tone deaf and ironic and ridiculous, where they're saying, yeah, the Iranians are fed up with their money, their government wasting money on foreign adventures instead of spending it at home. Like, really? And that means they're about to overthrow their regime, huh? So what does that say about us then?
Eventually, the Americans who are fed up.
Exactly.
With foreign adventures. But it's true. It's part of the totally warped view we have of Iran and its people. Ironically, it's one of the more democratic governments in the Muslim world. Not 100%, but I'd say I call it half a democracy. And compare it to the Saudis, ultra-reactionary, backwards, sort of far-right-wing Bedouins. Iran comes across as a civilized country, unlike our allies, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states.
Right. I remember when I was a little kid learning about, you know, in this far away, mysterious place, Saudi Arabia, they still cut your hands off for stealing, cut your head off for murder, this kind of thing. And then come to grow up and find out that, yeah, they're our closest satellite state of the empire over there in the Middle East. And, you know, we fight wars for them all the time.
Well, I just read a very interesting article on the nexus between the Israelis and the pro-Israel groups in the States and the Washington PR firms and the Gulf states. Saudi Arabia and Qatar. We see that Qatar is supporting pro-Israeli groups in the United States with money.
That's interesting. What piece is this specifically now?
Well, you know, it's one of these things, Scott, where I read it, and I can't remember where I read it because I read so much stuff. I think it was in the maybe in the Washington Post.
All right.
It was some online source. So
okay. I'll find it. Qatari support for Israeli groups in the U.S., right?
But it's focused on lobbying. Uh-huh. Now, Qatar is spending $16 million, I think, a year on lobbying. But it's gotten the Gulf states like Qatar and the United Arab Emirates have really gotten in cahoots with the Israelis. They have similar plans. And they are now best friends. We knew it, but I haven't seen it so vividly expressed.
Yeah. Well, I'll see if I can find that. Yeah, and of course, there are all new think tanks that we should have a master list somewhere to share about all of these. But, you know, the Middle East Institute and, you know, I don't know, a dozen more new ones that are all backed by the Saudis, basically playing the same game that the Israelis played. That, well, we'll just create our, you know, a half dozen or a dozen think tanks until we have, you know, basically cornered the market on foreign policy opinion. You know, just the way it used to be with the English. And they had their CFR, and the Israelis just created their, you know, seven different alternatives or 10 different alternatives to the CFR, and then they just drowned them out. And then they took them over anyway.
I've done radio and TV shows with some of these spokesmen for the Saudis and the Emiratis, who are Arabs that purport to be defending the rights of the Middle East, and turns out are closet advocates of U.S. right-wing and Israeli policy in the region.
Yeah.
Money talks.
Yeah. All right, now, but so here's the same thing that's always been the case, which is that the Pentagon doesn't really want to have a war with Iran, right? I mean, even if the Air Force and the Navy talk big about what they could do, the Army and the Marines don't want to have a war with Iran. Tell me that's the case again, please.
Well, it is the case. Or at last I heard, when I've been in the Pentagon consulting, it's that has been the case, too. The orders will, the senior officers will follow orders, if so ordered. But by and large, they worry about their institutional wellness. And the U.S. is fighting wars everywhere. I mean, I have an article here. We're running low on bombs. I learned that we may have to contract out bomb making abroad because we can't make them fast enough. We're
buying Wouldn't that be some- great? Start buying all their conventional bombs from China.
Well, yeah, from they'd be a lot cheaper.
Hey, listen, so was this the article, the Wall Street Journal, the new lobbying cutter targeted 250 Trump influencers to change U.S. policy?
That's the one.
Okay, great. So that's Wall Street Journal there.
Well worth reading and a bit unusual for the Wall Street Journal being so plain spoken.
Yeah. Well, I'll be interested to take a look at that.
Anyway, right. the senior generals don't want a war. When Bush, number two, was in power and wanted a war, pushed by the neocon cabal around him, there was almost an open revolt in the Pentagon and also the Defense Intelligence Agency and CIA. And remember, they came out with the national estimate, the NIE, it's called, which came out and said that Iran had no nuclear weapons, even though that was the reason being cited for invading Iran.
Yep.
So, and that scunners, they use a Scottish expression, the Bush administration claimed that it had to act to stop nuclear development. Its own intelligence people said there was none. Well, now fast forward, the reason was that the Americans are up to their ears in small wars, and wars cost money. And right now, the defense budget is being severely squeezed. A war against Iran would be a big deal. It's not just bombing a few local Arabs. Iran is a big, sophisticated country of 80 million people, and I know that the Pentagon had set up an initial target list of about 2,300 targets that would be struck. Mm-hmm. So, talking a big war.
Okay, and I know you already answered this, but just for perfect clarity here, just how crazy and stupid is it, not to prejudice the question or anything here, lead the witness, but just how crazy and stupid is it, say on a scale of 1 to 10, to think that what they would do is maybe pull off some kind of coup, some kind of regime change, and install the Mujahideen-y calk in power, or for that matter, the son of the Shah Pahlavi.
Well, I've met him, and let me tell you, he's no Shah. there's no one in Iran has any use for the Mujahideen. Kalk. They were a bunch of left-wing student radicals who turned into real terrorists. They assassinated a good part of the original Iranian government after the revolution. They command no respect in Iran. They were regarded as American stooges, which they are. That's who's financing them, with the support of neocon politicians in Washington. So the idea that, of attacking Iran, to answer your question, quote the great Talleyrand, Napoleon's foreign minister, who said, in regard to another issue, said, worse than a crime, it's a mistake.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say, they've learned nothing and forgotten nothing. would fit, too.
This was about the murder of the Duc d'Enghien, by Napoleon, and which was considered, even in those days, a major crime. So it was absolutely, the United States will never get itself out of Iran if it gets into a war there. It's going to have to put some troops on the ground. It can't just win the war by bombing. The Iranians are too smart and tough for that. And maybe the Israelis want Iran just bombed back to the Stone Age, as happened with Iraq. So it would be a smoking ruin that didn't threaten anyone. It would leave the Israelis carte blanche in the Middle East to do whatever they wanted. Almost the case now.
Well, you know, there was a quote recently from, I forget if it was the president or it might have been the head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, General Soleimani. I think it was the president who said that, you know, any Israeli attack would be treated as an attack by the United States and they would respond by hitting American targets, which I guess is a nice way of saying they can't reach Israel from Iran. There's no threat to Israel at all. Maybe they have a few missiles that could get there, but not with any real reliable accuracy, I guess. And so, but you know what? We could hit American troops in Kuwait, could hit American troops at the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, or hit oil refineries and you know, other corporate interests in Saudi Arabia, maybe the air base in Qatar or the Navy base in Bahrain, this kind of thing.
Well, that's right. He did say that. I noted it with great interest. Iran could hit Israel with some intermediate range missiles, but they're conventionally armed. And all they would do is get the Israelis really angry. And the Israelis might respond with tactical nuclear weapons, of which they have a great number. So the Iranians are very cautious about that. That's the reason that Iran would never attack Israel with nuclear weapons. It will be blown off the map. But it's surrounded by nuclear-armed Israeli forces in the sea, in the air, Israeli missiles. So Americans would be at risk, but who cares in Washington that some GIs would be killed by, quote, terrorists, unquote. So it's the price you pay. As the British used to say, it's the price of empire. I don't think that would deter Washington's neocons from pressing for a war against Iran. It's their greatest hope. It's their silver chalice.
You know what? I've always wondered, but I don't think I've ever asked any of you experts before. How come the Israelis don't have long-range bombers? The idea is they have F-16s, right? But nothing like a B-52. But why not?
They don't really need them. With air-to-air refueling, which the Israelis have, their long-range strike fighters, they like F-15s, and some models of the F-16 can hit every Arab or Iranian target that there is.
I was just thinking of in terms of payload, right? Like F-16 can only drop so many bombs compared to, and it doesn't seem like they're that hard to make, a long-range bomber, right? Especially if you have fighter escorts for them.
Well, they are. They're expensive. They've got their missiles. They've got submarine-launched missiles. They have their own land-based missile force that could take out every capital from Rabat, Morocco, to Tehran, to Tabriz in Iran. I'm not sure how they probably could hit Pakistan too. So the Israelis are too smart and dollar conscious to indulge in things that they really don't need. And the U.S. has given them F-15s, which come formal fuel tanks that and new air-to-air fueling technology that would allow them to go practically anywhere. They could hit Moscow.
Well, and I mean, their worst brinksmanship on Iran was back in 2000, I guess, 10 and 11 and 12 against Obama, which that was, you know, pretty obviously empty threats, I thought at the time. Although, I don't know, some of it was concerning anyway, if not completely convincing, that they would go ahead and start a war and try to force America into it. But, you know, one of the things is Obama really took away their last excuse for war when he doubled the locking down of the Iranian civilian nuclear program so that, I mean, it was already safeguarded anyway. As you said, the CIA already verified they weren't even making nukes in the first place. But, you know, the effect of the Obama deal was to take that fake issue off the table finally and say, no, we know for sure that they're not making nuclear weapons. So now that Trump has withdrawn from the deal and he's, you know, obviously he's reinstituting the sanctions, but the Iranians, I mean, they're at least right now, saw a story yesterday where they took it to the world court trying to get the sanctions lifted. They're trying to stay inside the deal. They, you know, have no real motive to make, what are they going to do? Make one nuke and not get attacked? While they're making the one nuke, you know, which they'd have to kick the IAEA out to make in the first place and, you know, would take them a long time to do. And, you know, the whole thing is ridiculous. But so, you know, I guess there's not really that much of a threat. But at the same time, there doesn't seem to be much of a resolution to the outstanding crisis either. But it doesn't seem like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, it doesn't seem like there's much of even a fake casus belli that could be drummed up at this point. You know?
Well, probably not, but the Israelis, some Israelis keep saying that there's a nuclear threat from Iran. Its friends in the U.S., the entourage around Trump keep beating on this drum, even though it's patently untrue. Just as untrue as that Iraq had nuclear weapons. Remember, I was one of the few guys, journalists, who came out and said at the time that Iraq had no nuclear weapons. And for this, I was kicked off CNN. It's a propaganda thing. Look, Israel is not afraid of Iran from a military point of view. It's violently anti-Iran because Iran supports the Palestinians. It's the only major country in the region that's still behind the Palestinians. Now that Iraq and Syria have been largely destroyed, that leaves only Iran as its supporter, and that it prevents Iran's strength prevents the Israelis from dominating the Gulf and possibly even the Saudi oil fields. That's what it's concerned about.
Yeah. All right, you guys, here's how to support the show. First of all, subscribe to the RSS feeds, iTunes, Stitcher, and all of that. All the feeds are available at scotthorton.org. And also at libertarianinstitute.org. You can also follow me on youtube.com/Scott Horton Show and sign up for Patreon. If you do, anybody who signs up for $1 per interview gets 2 free books from Listen and Think Audio. And also you'll get keys to the new Reddit page, reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. And then if you go to scotthorton.org/donate, $20 will get you the audiobook of Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. $50 will get you a signed copy of the paperback there. And a $100 donation will get you either a QR code, commodity disc, or a lifetime subscription
to Listen and Think Libertarian audiobooks. That's all at scotthorton.org/donate. And also anybody donating $5 or more per month there, if you already are or if you sign up now, you'll get keys to that new Reddit group as well. Already got about 50 people in there and it's turning out pretty good. Again, that's reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. If you're already donating or you're a new donor, just email me scott@scotthorton.org and I'll get you the keys there. And hey, do me a favor, give me a good review on iTunes or Stitcher, or if you liked the book on Amazon.com, and the audiobook is also on iTunes, and I sure would appreciate that. And listen, if you want to submit articles to the Libertarian Institute, please do, and they don't have to be about foreign policy. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, well, you want to hang on one more minute and talk about Afghanistan?
Of course.
Major Taliban attack on Ghazni. You could compare it to the Tet Offensive if you want to, one way or another. Not as an exact analogy, but maybe to cite the differences, whatever you think is wise about that. But of course, you know, at the same time, the background is that the Trump administration finally went along with the Taliban demand that they cut the Kabul government out of the chain and have direct talks, and they have been having some background talks toward the having of better and more talks and some slight ceasefires and this kind of thing, meeting in Qatar, in fact. I guess obviously on the face of it, the Taliban are showing that they're the ones in the position of strength going into these negotiations here. If the Americans want to do it, that they shouldn't think that they're going to get away with too much. But I don't know. What all do you think it means?
Well, the Taliban has been persistent in saying that we won't negotiate with the puppet governments in Kabul that the Americans put into power. We want to associate with real Afghans. I don't know who these real Afghans are, but certainly not the Kabul government. There's sort of a void that's been created, and the U.S. is partly responsible because it discouraged the growth of any nationalist parties that were not under the thumb of the government. So I'm not very positive about that. Also, look, in Washington, no one wants to take authorship of a disaster in Afghanistan. After 17 years of war and probably $4 trillion, God knows how many Afghan lives, not to mention 4,000 American lives and 25,000 wounded American GIs. What did we do this for? Nobody has an answer, but nobody wants to take authorship of this mess. And there's so many military and political careers that are tied up in this war. I mean, look at John McCain being deified by the pro-Trump media, by the government, pro-government media, as a great hero who kept beating the war drums for more war in Afghanistan. Biggest mistake we've ever made in the U.S. And all these generals, like people like Petraeus and things, who rose to prominence by pushing for this war in the mountains. So there's no lobby for peace in Washington. That's the problem. Average Americans don't understand it. They're not interested. It's faded from our consciousness. And so we have this war being fought by GIs from small towns down south and the U.S. air power, which sustains them. And how long that can go on, I don't know. It could be a lot longer.
Yeah. You know, I read a piece this morning, and I don't know, I think it was it's either the Washington Times or Defense News. I think it was the one in Defense News about James Mattis saying, you know, steady as she goes, boys, and all this kind of thing. You know, you never get a recognition on that level that, well, let's see. So back 8 years ago, we went through this same situation with Obama, and this is the Petraeus era you're talking about, where they demanded an extra 90,000 troops or an extra 60,000. End up, you know, adding up to 100,000 Americans and plus another 40,000 NATO troops. And they accomplished nothing. The whole thing was for nothing. Here we are right now. And so Trump sent, what, an extra 4,000 or 5,000 troops a year ago? And what difference is it supposed to make? Mattis is saying, you know, one day we'll have a negotiation because they're signaling that they want to negotiate now. But, you know, doesn't seem like there's much for them to negotiate other than the Americans leaving. They've basically held on this whole time. It's not like Petraeus' promise ever came true and now the Americans are dragging them to the table to surrender on our terms or anything like that. So, and the Taliban's terms have always been pretty maximal, such as get the hell out of here. And yeah, we still might take Kabul, you know?
That's right. The Americans don't want to see another helicopter evacuation from the embassy. That's what they're really scared about, because that whole Kabul government, a bunch of corrupt people, is going to collapse like a house of cards the minute the U.S. military and air power pulls out. It's, you know, run for the exits. And they don't want to see it. Nobody wants to take authorship for it. And there are a lot of people in Congress, these third-rate politicians we see there, who are still favoring the war because they're fighting Muslims. That's good. And they're keeping defense industries going. And their promotions in the military that come from this war, something that all the soldiers support. If we had more casualties, and if it were a bigger war, I think you'd start seeing anti-war sentiment in the States. But the Pentagon is very clever. They saw what happened in Vietnam. They said, we're not going to let that happen again. This is just a little war on the sidelines.
Yeah. You know, I'm hearing more and more kind of, not criticisms, but just honest, or I mean, I don't know, honest, but sort of, you know, open admissions that, well, you know, these arms manufacturers sure employ a lot of people, and those jobs are important. And the assumption seems to be, I guess, that if you close them all down, that no one would be able to come up with replacement projects for people to do with that same money that's being wasted on war. But the idea is no one wants to even take a chance on the short-term sacrifice of closing down the factory in their town, even though really it doesn't amount to that much, you know what I mean? Especially compared to the fact that, you know, in the end, all this is being wasted on equipment and on salaries for people who destroy things with that equipment. So none of it is really turning a real profit in any sense of material gain for anyone.
That's true, Scott, but the defense industry, and I own some defense shares, I have to admit, up right in front.
They've done, you must be a rich man now, I'll tell you what.
They've done very well. What the defense industry did was open up plants all over the country. They'd make a new warplane. They would make bits and parts, the wheels in one place, the wings in another. So that everybody in the country felt the prosperity coming from defense contracts, or screamed like hell if they were going to end the program. And, oh, my God, they're going to close the factory. The town's going to dry up. It shouldn't happen. So, yes, right, there's a built-in resistance to getting addictive defense spending.
Yeah, I guess the only difference now is, as they've run out of excuses for taming the Taliban or whatever it is that they claim to be doing, that now they're sort of openly resorting to saying, yeah, but we need those jobs. Instead of that kind of being a background motivation that everyone sort of knows that, you know, they're in on this to some degree or whatever we're made to feel like. Now it's the last excuse, you know, the last refuge of an imperialist. And seriously, you know, I guess it's something else. I just read Stephen Walt's new book, and just reading his takes on grand strategy about the way things are supposed to be. That, geez, if you were going to spend all this money to dominate a part of the planet, you would think that you would do it in a part of the planet that matters. What difference does it make who's dominating Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, for Christ's sake, in a world full of Europe, China, and Russia? You know, what are we doing? So I'm not saying I would favor and I don't think he's saying he would rather take on greater powers, but he's just saying, look at, if any other country was pissing all of everything, every last thing they have away in the desert sands of the Middle East, the way the U.S. is doing, think what we would say about them. and how stupid their policy is, their strategy for dominance is.
That's quite right, Scott. I agree with that entirely. And meanwhile, our new rivals, the Chinese, are building roads and ports and airports and building up their military. All the money that they're not wasting on these stupid, pointless wars, they're investing in their national strength. And we're already at the point now where we're getting squeezed for funds, the Chinese are not. So it's very worrisome.
Yeah. All right, now back to Afghanistan for a second. I have a dream that if the Americans just left, that the Kabul government could cut a deal with the Taliban that just says, hey, listen, you guys rule Pashtunistan and just don't invade Kabul and we won't bomb you anymore and no hard feelings, something like that. And yet I wonder how ridiculously hopeful that is and whether you think that actually, no, once the Americans go and that government falls, then the Taliban are going to march right into Kabul and then the wars with the Uzbeks and the Tajiks and all that are going to go on, only now with the Taliban in the dominant position and all the folks we've been backing for the last 15 years, 17, 18 years, will be the ones to be on the receiving end. And maybe we'll even go back to where we were in 2001 when America intervened here, really switching sides against the Taliban in favor of their enemies, the Northern Alliance, where they really only controlled like 10% of the very northwest part of the country at that point. Or what do you think is going to happen? Best case scenario or worst?
Good summary, Scott. I can see you're a real Afghan scholar. I think what will
my
happen,
book is actually based on your books, so
charmer. My experience in Afghanistan when I was there, both in the mid-80s and around 1991 when the war was ending and the Soviets pulled out, it was Civil War in 91, was that that every Afghan seemed to know somebody else on the opposite side. There are all kinds of tribal and clan links. There were no secrets. The Soviets couldn't do anything without the Mujahideen knowing about it weeks in advance. Every troop movement, every new rotation of troops, everything was known to the Afghans. So, and they all could see that the Soviet days were numbered. The writing was on the wall. And the writing is on the wall for the U.S. and Afghanistan too. The Afghans see that. So you can be sure that everybody there is calling up their cousin Saeed, who's on the other side, and saying, listen, we're going to get together. Let's have coffee. Let's talk. They're trying to, feather their nests or find a way when there is change and the collapse comes. So it might not be as catastrophic as the fall of Saigon. But I think that the Taliban will march into Kabul and that the current government will run like chickens, get on an American plane and fly off to Hawaii or something like that. And fighting will go on, but it'll be more of a peaceful change than we've seen in the past.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's a pretty big bubble to pop, but maybe not. You know, maybe there's not that many people to flee. I don't know.
Let's there, Scott. Well, let's report live when it's happening.
Yeah, you go, and I'll take your phone call. I'll take your Skype call. I think if they're going to Kabul, if they're determined to go to Kabul, then that's going to be bloody and ugly and horrible. I was thinking that maybe that they could learn from the current regime in Kabul's mistakes that, like, hey, you know what, maybe we could just have mutual autonomy and then instead of fighting over who's dominating who all the time after 40 years of this, you know. But I understand that there has to be hell to pay after America, you know, pulls their inflationary bubble out from under the power of those they've propped up here.
And bombs,
you know, there's a correction coming.
Scott, you remember in my book I quoted an old Afghan prayer, Indian prayer. Oh, Lord Shiva, save us from the fang of the cobra the tooth of the tiger and the vengeance of the Afghans.
Yeah, that makes sense. I could buy that. Although, well, I don't know. I guess there's this big peace march. Have you read about that? You know, all these people, all these activists marching from Helmand province up to Kabul and led by a blind man whose wife died and all this great stuff. I mean, memorable, important, moving stuff. I don't know. I mean, obviously people like that don't necessarily usually win the day. But it seems like 40 years is a long time to have your country at war, and mostly because a bunch of foreigners say so. You know what I mean?
That's right. Remember, the Taliban started that way by a march organized by a small town preacher, Mullah Omar, and seminary, Islamic seminary students joined, and some of them got arms from the Pakistanis. And they marched in their local area to stop brigandage and stop rape of women. That was the birth of Taliban.
Yeah.
It worked. And the government was so corrupt that it collapsed.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ahmed Rashid, actually you and he are both my footnote for just that part of the story right there. And I was reading him. He wrote the Taliban and I forgot the one about Pakistan. But anyway, I was reading him in the New York Review of Books today, and he's really afraid that they're gonna that the U.S. is gonna pull out, and you know, looking at the coming Taliban victory, you know, he's really worried about what's gonna happen to the people of the North. You could tell, which
I don't trust him at all. I think he's an American agent of influence, and he's constantly quoted in the foreign press because he says what we want to hear. I'd be cautious with Ahmed Rashid.
Well, his book, The Taliban, is pretty great. I mean, I think you'd like it if you haven't read it. But
I do have it somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he really tells a lot of that same story as you do. You know, it's a different perspective, but not much different on a lot of it. In fact, you know, he's the one who really I quote and borrow his sources to in quoting the Clinton administration talking about how they very well meant to help the Saudis and Pakistanis support the Taliban rise to power and how they didn't want a peace deal either. They wanted to make sure that the Taliban conquered the whole country so that they would have be able to provide the security for their pipeline and all that. And not that that worked out very well for them or anything, but that certainly wasn't the CNN version, which was we have to go save the people of Afghanistan from the Taliban before they destroy any more Buddhas.
And the women, that's right. You know, it's interesting, Scott, that that intervention by the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, etc., marked the beginning of independent actions by these states that we are seeing now in Yemen, for example, and other parts of the Middle East, where they've gotten too big for their britches. They want to be little Napoleons.
Yeah. Well, you know, a friend said to me the other day that when something big happens and she wants to know what's going on, she turns to you and to me. So I guess I'll be pleased that she'll be listening to this interview of you by me. And I'm very happy that I can continue to bring you as a guest to my great audience here. Your great work, Eric. Thank you very much.
Scott, I'm very happy to have you asking all the right intelligent questions.
I'm trying. All right, you guys, that's the great Eric Margulies. And I'm telling you, you don't even have any idea how good these books are. War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. They're both just excellent. And look up everything he writes at ericmargulies.com and spell it like Margolis, ericmargulies.com. All right, y'all, thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan at foolserrand.us.